never done this like Art Garfunkel thing. That might surprise you because of the hair. But we'll try it, you know. I've never sat for a poetry reading. It might be really relaxing. I might just like fall asleep here. Thanks, Joan, for setting this up. I know Justin and I have been meaning to read with each other for like 5 years, and clearly left to our own devices, we have not gotten our shit together. So, and thanks everybody for coming. And just, I want to congratulate a whole bunch of Chatham graduates over there. Yeah. they're leaving the nest. They're going to take the world by storm. I just know it. All right, I'm going to read a poem. I'm going to read a couple new poems first. And this one I'm reading because Tom is here. And before I ever met Tom, we were united in our distaste for flying in airplanes. Okay, this is called Denver to Tulsa. I don't fly unless there's a good-looking girl on the other side. A good-looking girl rocking her Stetson and her internship at Tulsa Studies for Women's Lit, foremost feminist journal smack in the buckle of the Bible Belt. I don't fly unless the risk of fiery death is offset by the chance that I might be saved. So when the pilot gets on and says, her name is Susan and she'll be my captain today, this should sound promising. Like an appropriately hot, radical send-off into the brazen arms of my lover. But I and 89 Republicans, fellow travelers, we all look up, startled, and grip the armrests a little more dearly, tighten our seatbelts, hope no one noticed. Please do not feel that applause between every poem is compulsory. It's not. What's the etiquette at a poetry reading? Who knows? This is a poem called, for now, it's called The Department of English 2011, but you know, anything can happen, so I'm open. In the dream, my students appear in a monsoon of neediness and nerve. First Miranda, who hallucinates, thin scars down the right-hand sides of window panes, wants to make them into poems. Then Mel, pushy, irreverent, wants to be a librarian. You worked in a library, McNarr, help me. She shoves poor Miranda, who looks up, bewildered, a six-year-old in a Motorhead jacket. Women's symbol fists, hand sewn down the sleeve. I cry, shoo, shoo. But they cluster by my bookshelves, whisper among themselves, unhearing and coy. In thunders Leslie, congenital limp in thigh-high black boots. Her poems use cell phones to set off Chechen bombs. The only undergraduate in 5 years to whom I've said, listen to me, you're the real deal. Since which she's been absent or drunk exactly 6 weeks in a row. Here they are, inexplicable as fog, advanced writing workshop, all clutching Dan Brown's Angels and Demons, spineless public library Bibles, which they shake at me. Diana, their leader, demands, Dr. McNarr, how are we supposed to write a paper on this crap? I shake my head. There's been a mistake. I would never assign. Then in this dream, I recall the dream I have every semester, where I stand in front of the class, yelling and waving for their attention, but they keep talking and laughing. No one's listening. And the shriller I get, the louder they get, the more I disappear. And when I look down at my Great Expectations lecture, it is in fact the lyrics to Depeche Mode's Black Celebration, which is at least British, but otherwise no help at all. I lean on the shaky supporting beam of my pedagogy and think, if I placate them, they'll go away. I peruse my shelves. How about a nice Grace Paley, I push. Much more relevant, yes? But they're on to relevance, and its adulterated soulmate, gender. They keep coming, Dickensian phantoms with real anxieties, bounding up the stairs. Family members, too, coiffed stepmothers cling to grimly suited patriarchs. The entire American middle class clamors to send its daughters to my quietly last gasping fourth-tier women's college. As I push the last unwieldy sophomore out my door into the mass, we, dozens of us now, look up. It's raining inside, raining all through the attic of my dream, and now the ceiling begins to crumble. Victorian rubble crashes through 6 decades of shoddy facade, and in the sudden torrential silence, I head for my secret back door, through which I've ducked hundreds of moon faces and their earnest, dysphoric, bulimic aspirations. Now I'm blown like an out-of-print chapbook down the back stairwell, along with 5 years of unshredded manuscripts, mine and theirs. I let it take me down, down the narrow wooden staircase where 140 years worth of ghosts are having a cigarette, an affair, second thoughts, PMS, an abortion, a Melrose Place marathon, a fight, group hug, a vagina monologue, a good cry, leftover cake, desire. The house begins to topple around me. I feel my molars after their long night's work. She says, "You had a nightmare. By the time I'm afraid, it's too late." Thank you. I was uncertain about that poem the last time I read it, so put it away for a little while. And all right, this is called At the Reading of a Famous Homosexual Poet. Some of you were at this reading. Some of you may recognize yourselves. At the reading of a famous homosexual poet, I fret over the comfort of Terence, who unfolds across the aisle to my right. I fret over the comfort of Tim, one row in front on my left, and I fret over the comfort of Dylan and Corey behind me, third row from the back. I have brought us here, my students, my boys, their approval, a wig I wear. In his jeans, Oxford shirt, and Yankees cap, D.A. Powell works undercover, a suburban dad, come to penetrate third base, come to perpetrate some poetry, come to play ball and shove us face first, dick down in the dirt. I miss the whole thing with my fretting. And I'm going to keep the chapbook alive here for a little bit, just for a poem. It's called 2000, and there's a line in here by Seamus Heaney. You'll recognize it because it's the most beautiful line in the poem. I did not write it. 2000, a year we spent leaving poems on each other's voicemail. I was drunk and drunkenly typing mad uselessness. Elliot Smith cheered me on. Mary Oliver, me, Seamus Heaney, you, my palpable, lithe otter of memory. I still steal things from people, hearts and lines, half decades. I still do whatever I want. It's just me now, almost. I am roughly myself again. I am close to approximating the person I was without you. Without you, the city is a flat, blank page that in a huff I crumple, not quite to death, like so many drafts, on and on, the sternumless, tedious dialing, the bottles piling up to warp the light and offer a wild stab at weeks. It's back when I wrote love poems. I don't know what happened, but I don't write them anymore. I don't think. I don't know. One of you could be like, no, this next one's a love poem. I don't know. I said I didn't write nature poems either, and then I wrote a bunch of them about birds. Really hackneyed for a poet, I know. I'm going to start in the book now. This poem's called The Precise Moment of Takeoff. When the falcon I've read about in the paper swoops past, I leap from my chair and follow one window, one room to the next. It lands on that tree over there. Together we wait, she on her branch, I in my bedroom. She is perfect stillness, my falcon, and goes on being perfect stillness for 1 minute, 2, 3. I need to see her fly again to learn how exactly she breaks stillness with flight. I'm not here for stillness. I'm here for the grand, imperceptible unlatching, the precise moment of takeoff, the shuddering in between. But my falcon, she takes too long. I chew a thumbnail, stretch my hamstrings along the snarling radiator, sigh a diminutive planet on the dirty pane. Whatever it is I want, I don't want it badly enough to wait another goddamn minute, watching what is, wanting more. I had a hard time thinking about what to read tonight. I don't know why. I'm trying to please a whole bunch of people in the room, I think. Good luck. Christ, what a setup. I have this poem about the 6 months I spent as a kid in Cleveland, and it's like the favorite poem that I ever wrote. And I was trying to like think about how to explain that. And it's just that if your poetry teacher gave you a prompt to say, like, write a poem that describes the feeling of meeting God, no pressure, right? But I feel like this kind of moment haunted me for a long time, and I feel like I nailed it, which I don't, I feel that way like maybe once a decade. So this is called Cleveland 83. You arrive with lice and are assigned the seat of a ghost. There's no school bus here, so no one's punched or fucked you yet. At recess, you study the sixth graders who, in their rugby shirts, have survived. The walk home is that nightmare in which you are chased as 1,000 leashless dogs sniff out the new, trembling 9-year-old. The apartment is asylum. Inside, it's a rough bath where, with enough will, you purge your scalp of lice, then vigilantly wipe from the tub your tiny gossamer holocaust. This poem has nothing to do with your mother, who's at work, testing junkies and homos in the new holocaust. The CDC pamphlets she brings home are atrocities from which you cannot look away, high gloss, herpetic, full-blown. These are the longest days of your life. It is safe to say you are still living them. Eventually, toward dinner time, you do what you came to do, Ziggy Stardust and American Graffiti. Funny, the things that save our lives. At the turntable, you kneel and sing. You sing and you sing. You're a kid, sad, but not unhappy. At night from bed, you whisper 10 serenity prayers and 10 Lord's prayers, the only prayers you know. In the end, you will live here less than half of the eternity that is your 10th year, and you will meet God. You have not one other choice. It's really a very optimistic poem. It starts with lice. But it ends with God. Pay attention. Okay, I'm going to read affirmations. It's my old standby. I can never not read this poem. I want your relationship to die, and yours, and yours too. Divorce, break up, move out are verbs for giddy. At the table beside me, a toddler wears glasses. Pink James Joyce frames a patch over one eye. She manages a tub of grapes and a picture book called Baby Wild Animal. Somebody's cut each green grape in half for her. Her new potato fists carry the miracle half moons one after the other into her darling, determined Joey mouth. Last night, the lesbian folk singer from Durham made me cry. I hope no one saw, and I hope no one lays her hand flat against my heart as she grazes my earlobe and sighs, Are you okay, world? Your guitars and your children, tell them, please, to stop. My first answer to any question is no, never. My advice is dump him. Dump him, dump her, dump the dog, too. Nothing elates me more than leaving. Her collarbones were less delicious than being right via telephone. Talk to me. Tell me about caring for an aging parent. I say dump them. Dump those folks in a home. I will manage to avoid the mayhem and folly that others have not managed to avoid. Trust is for chumps. Meanwhile, at the table, this child of the unbroken posture and Arthur onesie, her koala back is the breadth of one hand. I know because I reach out and almost bear it. So all my watches no longer have batteries that work, so I have no idea how I'm doing on time. I'm going to read one more. It's a short one, and I don't usually read this poem, but someone recently said she liked it. It's actually the poem I'm least sure of in the book, so thank you, Slevins. It's called Here to Help. As you approach your last sip of coffee before 8 on a Sunday morning, you will be tempted to ask, what now? Don't. Bob Haas said that Gary Snyder said, every 5 days he's a new person, so put that poem in a drawer till Friday. The thing to remember is the logistic and spiritual impossibility of your hands building a church of her thighs and writing a poem at the same time. Remember, you will spend at least 2 decades, maybe your whole life, trying. Don't forget to forgive yourself. Thank you very much.
That was awesome. That was